Love is a many splendored thing. It's the April rose that only blooms in the early spring. Any of you remember that? Love is nature's way of giving a reason to be living. I'm not going to go on. I'm not Humperdinck. I'm not Nat King Cole. A many splendored thing, this love, indeed. You know, that's a word that we don't use too often, is it? Splendor? But it's a wonderful word from the Latin splendere, meaning brilliance, light, magnificent richness. It is so pregnant with incredible ebullience. It's just overflowing. And it is hard sometimes for us to really grasp the biblical notion of love because of all the many ways in which it is rendered in popular words, in ballads, and so forth, all of which have their places, but they somehow pale in comparison to our understanding of what it is that Jesus is speaking of and what does the Bible mean about love. Even in that song, Love, a Many Splendored Thing, it does recognize the great potency of love, nature's way of giving us a reason for living, and it also talks about changing our heart and rendering us more open, as it were. But when we come to understand the biblical notion of love, we have to be clear about what it is Jesus is intending. Some of you may remember C.S. Lewis's book, The Four Loves, in which he identifies accurately the different words in Greek that are used for love. In our language, in English, we have only one word, and so sometimes there is much pressure being put on that word to convey a number of things. So we can say equally, I love praline ice cream, or for some of you it may be chocolate, and I love you, sweetheart. That word has to hold together all these things that have different meanings. But in the Greek, there were different words that were used. The word eros was used to describe romantic love, that cherished kind of goose pimply thing that people do, which is great. You know it is. Storge. Storge is a kind of an affectionate love, an affectionate love that you may have for a friend or for someone else. Even more specifically than the word philia, where we get Philadelphia, it's in the World Series, those of you following the baseball. Philia, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, philia, is a kind of love that might exist between family members or friends and so forth. There are some moving boundaries, as it were. And then the most supreme of which, that in Greek was reserved for the highest, most ultimate sense of love. And that is what is being used whenever you see these biblical references to love that Jesus is speaking of as summing up. It is this that he's speaking of. And you've heard of the word before, agape. Agape has nothing to do with feelings. Agape is not whether you like this or like that or feel you're in the mood for something. Agape is an act of will. It is a power of choice that is exemplified, that is presented or represented by commitment. Biblical love is not primarily about feelings, it is about commitment. It's the way of orienting our heart and our will and our energies and our commitment, as it were, toward doing those things that are godly, those things that God requires. That is why, both in the Hebrew Scriptures and in our New Testament, that kind of love can be commanded. Now, it doesn't make sense to command people, as it were, to be romantically involved with each other. I command you to love this person in that way. That doesn't make sense. That's not what is being commanded. What is being commanded is this commitment to orient your life and your heart and all that you are towards the purposes of God and the desires of God. That's why it's commanded, because it is within our capacity to choose to do it. It makes sense. In other words, it is a way of living into our true being. Someone once said that if God is love, then loving God is being in love with love. That may seem redundant, but really it has to do with living into our purpose as created in the image of God. If God is love, we are created in the image of God. We are meant for love. We are meant for this kind of choosing, this kind of expression of ourselves. So when the Pharisees come to Jesus to test him, listen to some of the drama that is going on there. They are trying to trick him. This is not a genuine kind of question. They're hoping, indeed, that he would trip himself up. Which of all these laws? There were 613 laws. There were 365. They were divided. 365 were negative type laws, you might say, or things that you are not to do. And that was to remind us that every single day of the year that we had to be vigilant, as it were. And then 248 what are called positive commandments. And the reason that that number was chosen is that 248 corresponds to the number of bones in our body. So in other words, the way in which the rabbis put these together was to say that every single day, all of ourselves, all of our structural being is meant to be involved in orientation towards God and towards neighbor in these various ways. And so the understanding was that all of these laws were important. So to pick one would be to cast a terrible pall, as it were, on the other. So they thought, okay, we've got him here. And it might have been easy for Jesus to respond and say, well, all of them are important. They're all the words of God. But Jesus goes further and really insinuates these words into their own sense of pomp and trickery. For what he does is quote the very basic prayer that was said by Jewish people in the morning and the evening, the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. In other words, any little child would know this. And so Jesus says, this is the great commandment. And the second, which he adds from both Deuteronomy and Leviticus, quoting from his scriptures, is like unto it, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Any little one would know that. Why don't you know that, you learned people? Any child would know that. Somebody once asked Karl Barth, how would he sum up the faith? Karl Barth was a famous German theologian. How would he sum up the faith? And Karl Barth, if any of you, Barbara knows this, his Church Dogmatics, his books, he has volumes and volumes and volumes about theology. You get a headache just reading this stuff, really. And he expected something very, very erudite, you know, this academician, this very strong intellect in the world of theology and biblical studies. How would you sum up the faith, they asked him. And Karl Barth responded, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. That's it. He said, it is simple but challenging. Any child would know it. So if it is simple, then what are the challenges that are pregnant within this commandment? What is so many splendored about this kind of love? What is brilliant about this love? For it is frightening in a sense. And I think that the word, the smallest word in all of the commandment sentences, is the one that frightens us the most, I think, if you and I are honest. It's only three letters, but it's repeated over and over again. And the import and significance of it is huge. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with... what's the next word? Ah, there it is. Ooh. Now, maybe a little bit, you know, God, I'm going to keep a little back. With all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. And remember, what happens when we try to define neighbor? What did the Samaritan, the story of the Good Samaritan, what did they discover in that? When we try to delimit and reserve certain people as neighbor and others as not, what happens? What does Jesus do to those kind of boundaries? Blows them completely apart. So the all, the reference of the all, goes also to neighbor. For everyone with whom we share this gentle, fragile planet is included in neighbor. Now that's the frightening thing, because maybe we can say, I can handle those that are near me. I can handle a little bit. But what is this notion about loving you with all my strength and all my heart? I want to reserve some places in my heart for other things, God. Why do you have to ask for all? All our heart. All our heart is the way we love. It's the orientation of our whole life. And it's important to say that when we say heart and mind and strength, yes, they identify different parts of ourselves, but in Jewish thought, all of these are unitive. They are blended together. There are different ways of expressing it, but they're blended together. Our soul, that deepest part of ourselves, that core, the bedrock of ourselves, that is meant to be oriented also towards God and towards neighbor. Love God with everything you've got. Dorothy Day, founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, said that our love of God is only as strong as the person we love least. Very early on in the Christian scriptures, we saw this very important commandment taken up. For Paul in Romans and Ephesians repeats it over and over, love your neighbor, love your neighbor. The epistle to 1 John says you cannot, be clear, you cannot love God and hate your neighbor. If you hate your neighbor, you cannot love God. Did you hear what I said? If you hate your neighbor, you cannot love God. So if people go around saying, yes, I love God, I believe in God, I believe, and they hold animus and hatred towards others, the Bible says you really don't love God. Now, those are strong words. But remember, what is the love we're talking about? Some people get confused and they think when we talk, for instance, around forgiveness, that to love your enemy means you have to have this affection for your enemy. The love being spoken of here, remember, is that which is commanded. In other words, we must choose as an act of commitment to desire and to pray for the well-being of even our enemies. And the reason it is commanded, again, is because it is within our capacity to do so by the power of God's Spirit, not on our own strength. To hold on to anything that separates us, that hatred eats us alive. I made a note of this. I wanted to get the right word for these little snails. In the Bay of Naples in Italy, there are these snails called nudibranch snails. And some of you may have heard of them. These nudibranch snails are covered in a shell that can't be digested. Also living in the same bay are the jellyfish. And the jellyfish love to feed on these snails. They somehow find them desirable. And so they think they're eating a tasty snack when they swallow them up. But what these nudibranch snails do, once they get inside, they come out of that shell, that undigestible shell, attach themselves to the wall of the jellyfish and eats it from the inside out and kills the jellyfish. I think that's a very potent and vivid image for what happens when we harbor hatred, when we harbor animosity towards a neighbor. It gets inside of us. And it eats us from the inside out. You know that to be true, don't you? And so, if we want to be selfish, one way of understanding this commandment is to realize it's self-preservation. Don't get eaten from the inside out alive. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Love God. In this law, these two great relationships we said the other week, love of God and love of neighbor hangs all the other. It's a powerful lesson for us, I think. And one of the things that is very surprising and why this is so difficult is because of the very words that Jesus uses. On these two laws, on these two commandments, hang all the others. Do you know that word that Jesus uses? Is the same word that's used to describe his crucifixion experience. For we slew him and hanged him on a cross. Loving God and loving neighbors, we love ourselves, is so important and requires a sacrifice of our ego, a sacrifice of our prejudices, a sacrifice of our will to the will of God. It is a crucifixion. That is why this commandment is so difficult, and yet it is our calling. Because it is like a crucifixion. We are laid bare in order that what may rise, what may be resurrected, is our true nature. For we are made in the image of God who is love. And when we love, we replicate and represent most nobly, most brilliantly, in many splendid ways, the God who has made us. So, the question we ask, what does it look like to love God and love neighbor when we are people of great privilege? If we have homes that have empty rooms in them, what does it mean to love God and neighbor with the homeless who live in our city? If we have closets full of clothes, what does it mean to love God with those who are naked and poor? If we have pantries and fridges full of food, what does it mean to love God and neighbor? If we're feeling well supported and in community and encouraged, what does it mean to love God and neighbor for those who are despairing and depressed and lonely? Do you know, in the Genesis story, the only thing that God pronounced was not good in all of creation, do you know what that is? Loneliness. Loneliness. It is not good that the Adam should be alone, needed a partner. There are people who are dying of loneliness, of alienation and disconnection. What does it mean to love God with all our soul and heart and mind and strength and love neighbor as ourselves? What does it mean in practical terms? I'm going to close with three references. One, this past week I had to make a quick trip down to Toronto for the launch of the TVO special. They've profiled a number of Ontarians who are trying to change the world. And you remember early in the spring there was a film crew came and did some filming here and at the school and some of the things that I've been doing. But what's more important than that is that I met people, including a 10-year-old girl, all kinds of folks, involved in something called getinvolved.ca. And it is highlighting and demonstrating the commitment and the innovation and what I would call the love of those who want to spend their intellect and time in order that others may be blessed, in order that others' lives may be upheld. I met a woman who runs a horse farm, and she brings especially cerebral palsied and partially paralyzed people and so forth, and they ride the horse. And apparently what they've discovered is that riding a horse in gentle striding moves involuntary muscles inside the body. And there was one very spectacular case of a young person who came, who were told and written off by the doctors would never walk again, and after a few weeks of riding started to make some steps. They're not quite sure how or why. Love of neighbor in practical ways. In our most recent newsletter, the second thing I would draw attention to, we have a very special story of someone from our congregation who has felt the call of God upon her life to share in ministry in a particular way by embracing some of the lonely and disconnected children in our city, to become a big sister and to extend that time and grace. Read of that story that Carolyn so aptly describes. There are many stories that could be repeated in our lives, and that is why we need to rehearse them and encourage one another to do this difficult thing. None of us lives up to these commandments. We don't. Let's just get that clear. The important thing is that we desire to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. The important thing is that we desire to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. That we desire to live into our identity as created in the image of God as people of love. That is who we are. What is your name? A person of love. That's your name before whatever name you've been given. whether it's Anthony, whether it's Eleanor, Ted, Barbara, before you have been given a name by your parents, your name, my name, is love. It is our identity made in the image of God. And I want to close with a quote from Thomas Merton, who I think aptly speaks of this. Thomas Merton, as you know, was a monk, a certain special person who indeed used his life and his reflections to gentle up, as it were, to gentle up the ways in which we approached our faith. And he demonstrated and said that if we indeed are going to live our lives in special ways, that we need to open up to that reality of love. This is what he wrote. To say that I am made in the image of God is to say that love is the reason for my existence. For God is love. Love is my true identity. Selfishness is my true self. Love is my true character. Love is my name. If therefore I do anything or think anything or say anything or know anything, this is not purely for the love of God. It cannot give me peace or rest or fulfillment or joy. To find love, I must enter into the sanctuary where it is hidden, in the mystery of God. In the mystery of God, that is love, we discover our identity. Thanks be to God. Love is a many splendored thing. It is a many splendored thing. Let us live in the brilliance of our identity in God. Amen.